will keep the door open, and I will go more than 50% of the way to meet with anybody who's willing to. You know, I said earlier that I have the utmost respect for people in the House of Bishops who've been willing to stay at the table, even when they disagree. And I think that is our hope.
That's the voice of Catherine Jefford Shorey. She's going to be meeting this week in Tanzania with the other presiding bishops of the other 37 provinces in the Anglican Communion. Worldwide Anglicanism is about 77 million people, and the Episcopal Church USA is a small but rather wealthy province in the entire Worldwide Anglican Communion. We're going to talk about what kind of reception and what kind of questions she might be answering when she meets with the other primates in Tanzania this week. I'm Todd Wilkin. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Father Todd Wetzel is our guest. He's executive director of an Anglican Reform group based in Dallas called Anglicans United. Father Wetzel, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be back.
How do you explain Catherine Jefford Shorey's apparent popularity here in the United States, and you think that popularity is going to follow her to Tanzania?
Well, at the risk of sounding controversial, I can explain her popularity in the United States with a simple word. We're not theological in our thinking, and we've been dumbed down in our churchmanship, which means we don't think in terms of Orthodox theology, and we don't think in terms of effective, faithful Christianity. We think in terms like, is she nice? Is she articulate? Is she representative of a radical feminist viewpoint? And that tends to make her very popular. It doesn't make her any more faithful. But Tanzania will be concerned with her willingness to be a voice for Orthodoxy and for faithfulness, and she will be unpopular there.
What's going on in Tanzania? What is the nature of this meeting?
It is, I believe it's an annual meeting of archbishops of Anglican provinces from around the world. There are somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 million Anglicans in the world. Most of those Anglicans live in what is called the two-thirds world. And most of them are evangelical, Orthodox, very faithful, and are the inheritors of churches that are the result of 19th and 20th century missionary movements in their country. Many of those missionaries, by the way, came from this country from a time when it was more faithful, more Christian than it is now.
So what do you think she's going to face by way of questions or issues when she meets with the other 37 primates?
Clearly she's going to be questioned on her support of Jean Robinson, who is at this point the only publicly avowed practicing homosexual bishop. She was very supportive of that election in 2003 and has continued to maintain her support for it. That election is viewed as sort of the ignition spark for much of the division that has ensued since. She will be asked about her views on the Bible and on Orthodox faith. She has recently made some very outrageous statements about the atonement as not being central to the Christian faith. She will most certainly be asked about that. Through it all, she will do what she does well, which is to maintain a very nice, gracious, unflappable exterior, which really bespeaks the fact that she is very much out of touch with worldwide Christianity.
She has very, I guess, one of the things that I find remarkable about her ascendance is that she really has very little experience as a as a priest first, and then as a bishop. She's really, I mean, not to, she's in a lot of ways unexperienced. Is she ready to go and deal with the other primates, to stand in the company of these other primates, many of whom have, well, to say the least, they've endured an awful lot in the name of their faithfulness to the Orthodox Christian faith?
Well, you could certainly argue about her credentials, but she was duly elected and is therefore authorized to speak, at least in part, on behalf of the Episcopal Church. But you have to remember, she is not an archbishop, meaning she does not have episcopal authority over the diocese in the United States. She has very, very limited authority as the presiding bishop in our House of Bishops, but she has no authority within any given diocese of the United States. Therefore, she does not carry an equal rank with archbishops. And that was very deliberately decided by the founding fathers of the Episcopal Church over 200 years ago.
To have that variation on the form of government that most Anglicans observe?
Correct.
What was the, just as a matter of interest, what was their rationale in making the government, diffusing the authority of church government in their province?
Well, the practice of Christianity was not at one of its high moments during the founding of this country. However, many archbishops and bishops functioned as almost as secular princes. And the United States founders were very leery of that much authority being concentrated in one person's hand and the expense of maintaining them in that office. So they deliberately avoided the use of any archiepiscopal title and simply created a presiding bishop, and initially, and for over 150 years, as the oldest bishop in the House of Bishops.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Seniority got you the title.
Correct.
When did that change?
Changed just after World War II.
All right. Let's talk about, you mentioned that she has no authority to within individual dioceses or congregations of dioceses in the Episcopal Church USA. Very limited authority, in fact. But as a province, does the Episcopal Church USA, how is it positioned in worldwide Anglicanism? Why is it given so much attention, taken so seriously? I was under the impression it's one of the smaller provinces.
It's certainly one of the smaller provinces numerically, but it is one of, by far, the larger province financially. I mean, it's a simple, it's the way the world works. Money gets attention.
I'd like your reaction to some of the things that Bishop Shorey has said in the press. This comes from the New York Times. I quote, in an interview last week, Jefford Shorey said that the conflict, this having to do with in her church, is more about biblical interpretation than about homosexuality. Quote, we have had gay bishops and gay clergy for millennia, she said. Quote, the willingness to be open about it is more recent. Your thoughts there?
Well, it bespeaks the limits of her education outside the field of oceanography. In fact, the use of the term gay is recent within the 20th century. I'm sure it's entirely possible that historically we had bishops with homoerotic feelings and indeed practices, but that is largely speculation. Since very few, if any, of them wrote about it, and very few, if any, of those writings have survived. So it's pure speculation. But the use of the term gay specifically derives from people who desire to claim themselves a member of a group and specifically a group of genetic origins, that's new in all of human history.
It's interesting the argument she makes there, which is essentially we've been here all along and no one ever bothered us until we kind of came out of the closet. Is that essentially what she's trying to say about homosexual clergy? In other words, it seems she's almost insinuating that the church didn't have a problem with it all this time until, what, American puritanical sensibilities kicked in.
Well, part of that has to do with Scripture. Scripture clearly identifies homosexual practice and relationships as sinful. And very, very clearly calls for repentance. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. I'm sure there are people who have been tempted by homosexual feelings. The difference is, in today's world, people have begun to say, no, in fact, it is not a sin, it is a blessing. And that's major departure from Scripture and from all of traditional Christian understanding of human sexuality. And that's the problem.
So here's something else she's quoted as saying in the New York Times. Quote, the folks who are unhappy represent a small percentage of the whole, but they are quite loud. She says it is primarily a handful of primates that have made it appear as if the bulk of the Anglican Communion was arrayed against the Americans when this was not the case. Your response?
Two-thirds of the primates of the Anglican Communion are on record as either strongly considering or having already broken communion with the American church. That's hardly a small percentage. 67% is not small. So I would beg to differ with her on her understanding of statistics and her review of the Anglican Communion and its leadership.
How would you respond to someone who says, look, many of these conservative primates come from third world countries. You mentioned the two-thirds there. They're not as enlightened as we are here in the U.S. How would you respond to that, Father Wetzel?
Well, in fact, I have met many of them personally, and by and large, they are theologically far more astute than the typical American bishop. Many of them have degrees from some of the finest universities and theological schools in the world. They are hardly unsophisticated, although many of them have English as a third or fourth language. So to those who lack patience or who are unwilling to simply exhibit a measure of understanding based on some of their limitations, I can see where they might say, well, they're a bit slow. But they are far from ignorant or unsophisticated.
So is it going to simply be a...
That's a very prejudicial statement.
Is it going to be the case in Tanzania that there will be primates unwilling to actually meet if Catherine Jefford Shorey is part of the assembly? Will it perhaps even extend to the communion rail if the primates are called to worship together?
I think that's likely, but I wouldn't presume to guess what any individual primate or primates will do when the time comes.
Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who is titular head of Worldwide Anglicanism, what do you expect him to do? It's going to be a tense meeting, to say the least.
His options are rather limited. Like Jefford Shorey, he has very, very limited authority to act, and especially to act independently. He has shown remarkable skill at keeping parties at the table and talking, but he has virtually no authority to compel it. At some point, the patience of two-thirds of the archbishops is going to wear thin, and they will begin to act independent of his direction.
Finally, then, Father Wetzel, back here at home in the Episcopal Church USA, how serious is the rift that has developed since 2003 with Gene Robinson and then exacerbated this last summer with the election of Catherine Jefferts Schori? Again, in the New York Times, it says a spokesman for the church, the Episcopal Church USA, said that a mere 45 of the 7,400 Episcopal congregations have left and affiliated with provinces overseas. Is that a fair representation of what the fallout has been?
No. It is a serious rift. However, it's probably not the most serious problem the Episcopal Church has. Its problem is a failure to be honest with itself about its own size. By all standards of statistical measurement, the 2.4 million members doesn't hold up. 800,000 in attendance on a Sunday morning doesn't hold up. And the 7,400 churches doesn't hold up either. Even in 1992, the Episcopal Church measured its churches at 7,200, and no one has stated that we have grown since 1992. So the Episcopal Church is clearly shrinking at a pretty alarming rate. That's a major concern. Two, the rather limited number of departures, considerably more than 45, but nowhere near 10%, for example, is indicative of the degree of apathy among a good many Episcopalians in the pew. I would venture to guess, and I don't have statistical backing for this, that we're looking at about 10% of the church being followers of what would be called liberal revisionism, and about 10 to 15% of the church clearly being Orthodox Christians, with a very vast middle that are either ignorant of what's happening by choice or by persuasion, or who simply don't care. That's a major, major problem, I think.
Do you have a guess as to the real size of the Episcopal Church USA in 2007?
I would venture to guess that we are below 6,000 effective parishes in size, that our numbers are closer to about 1.8 million, and that our attendance on Sunday mornings, on average, is about 650,000. I'm guessing that.
Father Todd Wetzel is executive director of an Anglican reform group based in Dallas called Anglicans United. Their website address, anglicansunited.com. It's all one word, anglicansunited.com. Father Wetzel, thank you again for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about the Beatitudes, that section of Matthew's Gospel where Jesus teaches, and he teaches about being blessed of God. Dr. Jeff Gibbs will be our guest tomorrow on the program. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February is a bit of history. Now, it's valuable not only because it's history, but because it is primary source history. That's the best kind of history there is. The real documents, the actual words of those involved in the events. The event in question is the Lutherans' battle for the Bible in the 1970s. You can read all about it and in the words of the people actually involved in our new Issues, Etc. book of the month for February. It's called A Seminary in Crisis. It is, in fact, a moment in history where our church body, the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod, narrowly averted going the way of mainline liberal Protestantism like the Episcopal Church USA and so many others. To find out more about A Seminary in Crisis, you can go to our website, issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, A Seminary in Crisis. Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to be going through some comments from our listeners and from those who called our Issues Etc. listener comment line. What it is, it's a new line that we've set up. The number's 314-505-7825. 314-505-7825. And we invite our listeners to call in, good, bad, ugly. We want to hear any response that you have to anything we've talked about on Issues Etc. You don't have to agree. In fact, we actually kind of get a kick out of it when our listeners don't agree with what we've had to say here. The number, 314-505-7825. It's the new Issues Etc. listener comment line. Now, this week we got a number of comments. I think, a little more than a half dozen comments there. And one thing I've noted among the comments is that they are running positive, which is nice. It's always nice to get positive comments, but the line is also open for those who want to register. And if you want to anonymously, that's fine too. Register negative reactions to anything we've said here on the air during the week or anything you've listened to in archive audio. A lot of our comments are coming from people who are iPod listeners, people who listen to the archived audio. 314-505-7825 is the Issues Etc. comment line. Are we ready to go with the comment line there, Jeffy?
Yeah, we're calling. I think the first one, Todd, is one that was misdirected to my voicemail.
All right, let's hear what this listener had to
say. Hold on a second here. I did it wrong.
Oh, Jeff. See, you don't trust a producer to push buttons, especially this one pushing buttons. We've actually got him pushing buttons and trying to talk at the same time, which is very difficult. He's not bad at talking on the telephone, by the way. It's what he does, for the most part, for a living. But actually, doing that in live radio was a different story. All right, Jeff, are we ready with this one? He's dialing.
Hold on a second here.
Little classical music to keep you entertained in the middle of the afternoon.
Issues, etc. Listener comment line. Please leave your message after the show.
It's wanting me to leave a message. Not letting me play them.
Jeff, you're calling. Now, what you need to do is check the messages. It's not that hard. He hoped to get one in before we go to this break. I don't think we'll be able to sneak one in before the break. We'll get to some of those listener comments on the other side. And hopefully, during the break, Jeff will get his fingers of fury flying fast over the little keyboard there to give us one of our listeners' comments. We'll play enough number of them, and then we want to hear from you, your comments as well. We'll just kind of open up the phone lines for audio open lines with our listener comments and your comments, too. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We also accept comments over email, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org, and that's coming up after the break. Then, at 5 o'clock, there in the third hour, John Rocca is going to join us from the Institute for Creation Research based in Santee, California. He's a genetics researcher. Today would have been Charles Darwin's 198th birthday, had he survived. But apparently he was not among the fittest to have survived. Of course, nobody lives to be that old. But who knows, with evolution, if Darwin was right, why not? We won't be wishing a happy birthday to Mr. Darwin. We'll be looking at his theory coming up in a half hour here on Issues Etc.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues Etc.
How would you answer the question as to whom should be considered the worst preacher in the history of the world? You can even use the Bible or come up with the name of someone living today or who has lived since the time of the Bible. You will hear our answer on the next broadcast of Law and Gospel, and I am sure it will surprise you.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
The state of Missouri bestows upon one person each year the title of Older Worker of the Year. In 2007, this person could be you if you are at least 55 years of age, work 20 hours a week or more, and display dependability, loyalty, new skills, and self-motivation on the job. Finalists will be recognized in Jefferson City this spring. To find nomination forms, visit online, www.dhss.mo.gov. All entries must be postmarked by March 14th.
AM 850 KFUO and Build-A-Bear Workshop.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer.
We're giving away three Congress's Build-A-Bear
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Congress is giving us a good read on where their priorities are. The House Judiciary Committee last week passed a bill that increases the penalties for transporting animals across state lines for the purpose of sport fighting. In the same breath, they refused to hear an amendment that would make it illegal to transport a young girl across state lines to get an abortion. Steve Jordahl has the story.
The committee was considering H.R. 137, which would protect animals, specifically fighting roosters, from exploitation. Ranking member James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin thought it would be appropriate to protect another exploited class.
I offered an amendment to have the House Judiciary Committee approve, as a part of this bill, the Interstate Transportation of Minors for Abortions Prohibition Act.
Chairman John Conyers used a procedural ruling to kill the amendment.
It's shocking that the Democratic majority in Congress decided to give more protection to chickens than to give to pregnant minor women and their parents and unborn babies.
Pennsylvania Congressman Joe Pitts remembers Speaker Nancy Pelosi surrounding herself with children at her swearing-in and saying this would be the year of the children.
Well, not all of the children, not the unborn children, now not these little girls who are being taken without their parents' knowledge or consent across state lines for an abortion to evade state law. This is the kind of battle that we will have this year. We will not win very many because we don't have the votes.
The exchange in committee did produce the quote of the day from Sensenbrenner, who asked, isn't protecting our nation's young women equally, if not more important, than our dinner entree? For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
So far this session, Democratic leadership in the House has considered all legislation under what's called closed rules. No amendments are allowed on the floor. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Concordia Publishing House and Issues Etc. are pleased to offer our Book of the Month for February, titled A Seminary in Crisis. It's a history book that you won't be able to put down. A Seminary in Crisis tells the story about the battle for the Bible in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in the early 1970s. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The book, A Seminary in Crisis.
AM 850 KFUO and Build-A-Bear Workshop has fun for you this Valentine's Day.
We're giving away three Build-A-Bear Workshop teddy bears on the morning show.
Listen for the sound of us blowing you a kiss.
That's your cue to call and register for the drawings on February 14th.
One registration per household. See the trio of cute, cuddly bears at KFUO.org.
Be sure to listen for the kiss weekday morning.
It's your cue to call and register for a Build-A-Bear Workshop teddy bear.
From the all-new morning show on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to be listening to some listener comments here during the next few minutes of the program. Then John Rocca will join us to talk about Charles Darwin and his theory of evolution. Just got a note from someone who was reacting to a recent conversation. We were talking about a six-day creation. Apparently doesn't think much of, as far as I can tell from the note, doesn't think much of the Genesis account of a six-day creation. No surprise there. Then we have audio open lines in the last half hour of the program. There was a Muslim imam who's been much in the news, and he's kind of a gadfly in Washington, D.C. Well, he had actually advised President Bush at several points early in his war strategy, and then appeared more recently at a Democratic National Convention, not the National Convention, Democratic National Committee event, and said a prayer that made the news. Hannity and Combs interviewed the imam, asked him what he was up to. We'll play both the prayer and that interview coming up in about an hour here on Issues Etc. during audio open lines. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Jeffy's on the phone.
If you'd like to try and
here we go. It's the listener comment line.
You have reached the switchboard at Concordia.
All right. Hold on a second. Bring up your mic. Bring up Jeff's mic there, if you would. Okay, Jeff. You do this for a living. You talk
on the telephone for a living. What's that? Yeah, I talk on the telephone, but I don't know how to dial, apparently.
Well, you know, if you can't actually get to this comment line, those things just, they just are electrical impulses someplace. We need you to be able to...
This is going to happen right now.
It is?
I'm putting my reputation on the line
all
right here.
All right, everything, all the chips. He is all in. All the chips are on the table. This is his last card to play to get access somehow, miraculously, to the new issues, et cetera, comment line. And we thank everybody very much for contributing to it. You can do it anonymously. You don't have to leave your name or any information. It's just for your comments on anything you've heard on issues, et cetera, either through the course of a broadcast week or if you listen on demand, you can also comment on any of that.
The message is...
Hey, Jeff. I was actually trying to find the new comment line, but I got lost. But I'll leave my comment here anyways. I listened to the show on podcast, and I was just listening to the show on Eternal Rewards, and it was really good. I grew up in the evangelical church, and one of the verses that stuck out to me as a guest was sharing was Galatians 2:20, and I was always taught that that verse meant that you had to do something to crucify yourself. And it was kind of a work that you had to do to be crucified with Christ. The past couple of years, I've been at a LCMS church, and just the freedom of the gospel has really spoken clearly to me and removed a lot of that, searching out your rewards and what you can earn for yourself through Christ. And I just wanted to share that with you. All right. I really enjoy the program. Been listening on the podcast for a few months now, and really enjoy what you guys are doing. All right, have a good one.
How often do we hear from people like this, Jeff? I mean, we hear from people all the time who say, I used to be an evangelical, and this is what I was taught. And, you know, I think sometimes, are you painting with too dark a brush when it comes to pop American evangelicalism? And then I hear from evangelicals who have been literally talked down off the ledge by good sound Lutheran theology, they're ready to, as Rod Rosenblatt often says, give up on everything, Christianity and Christ included, having lived under the burden of the law that runs so much of American evangelical teaching and preaching, where they said, oh, you're saved by faith in Jesus Christ, but now it's time for you to get busy, and it's you are a Christian, but if you want to stay a Christian, you better get busy and do your works. How different is that, really, essentially? Especially in its outcome, than medieval Roman Catholicism? It isn't, but it's very gratifying to hear listeners, and there are many of them, either through the comment line or via email, who say the same thing about coming to a sound, Christ-centered, cross-focused Reformation theology. We got another listener there from the comment line. Let's hear it. You got the switchboard again. Oh. He's very lucky. I'm an extremely patient talk show host. Now, okay, here we go.
This is Paul of Milwaukee. I'm calling about the broadcast yesterday, February 1st, Private Confession and Absolution with Susan Geldach. She is a brave and articulate woman, and I learned from her broadcast. But a couple of points. One, she said that she wanted a pastor who didn't believe in penance, that the pastor in the confessional situation was there to forgive. Well, the last is true, but I think the historic Christian church has imposed penances, penalties on individuals, and perhaps common sense at any rate might say that these penances could be salutary. They may have been abused in Luther's early days and before and since, but some penalty or some deed, at least historically, in the right situations, has been in order. Second, Ms. Geldach talked about the sacrament of private confession. I think the Christian church has been on both sides of the issue as to whether confession was a sacrament or not. I believe Luther might have said that it could be a sacrament, but we can turn to our catechism and find that a criteria for a sacrament is a visible means. So my question to the guest on the program would be, what would be the visible means in the sacrament of private confession? Last, in order to keep Ms. Gelbach and Reverend Wilkin as long as possible in the church militant as opposed to the church triumphant, they might check, which I think I can easily do, about the calories and fat involved in Butterburgers and Culver's desserts, Culver's being a very rapidly growing restaurant line in the Midwest. I think they might be surprised. I go to Culver's myself, but I use their salad menu rather than other things. So as they pummel their bodies, they might consider the calories and fat and the like at Culver's. Thank you for listening. And as I say, I think this line is a good idea. Goodbye.
All right. Okay, thank you very much. That was from Paul in Milwaukee. Hey, Jeff, is Paul a doctor?
Not a medical doctor?
Yeah.
No, not a medical. He's a teacher.
Oh, he's a teacher.
Yeah, he's a college instructor.
Well, I mean, he knows more about the fat content in Culver's Butterburgers than I do. I mean, anything called Butterburger already tells you that you've got a serious problem, perhaps, with fat and cholesterol and those kind of things. Luckily, I don't frequent Culver's that much, but just the word Butterburger sounds so good by itself. He had a couple questions there, and I'll answer them very quickly before we go on to the next comment on the Issues Etc. comment line. He asked whether or not, because he's picking up off a conversation we had with an excellent guest on private confession and absolution. And in that conversation, she said, well, one of the things she was looking for in a pastor was one who didn't believe in penance. Now, penance is the Roman Catholic practice of, along with confession and absolution, added to that, these penances, these deeds that, at least according to their teaching, are not done in order to procure forgiveness of sins, but order to demonstrate true repentance and faith in the forgiveness of sins. So he asked, could a little penance be a good thing? My response would be no, because Christ did not give us penance. He gave us the binding and loosing of sins. Whoever sins you retain, they are retained. Whoever sins you remit, they are remitted. That's what Christ gave to us, and he did not give us penance. So if he didn't give it, we shouldn't be practicing it. The other question he had was whether or not we could consider confession and absolution a sacrament. Well, I think we most certainly could consider it a sacrament if we understand sacrament to be those things instituted by Christ. We've already got Christ's institution. There's no doubt about that. Which are those means of grace by which Christ delivers the benefits of his death and resurrection to sinners, namely the forgiveness of sins, life, and salvation. In that sense, there's no doubt that private confession and absolution, confession and absolution for that matter, are a sacrament in that sense. Now, if you go with kind of the Augustinian definition of a sacrament, which has an institution of Christ, a promise of forgiveness, and a visible element, then you're on shakier ground. I will admit that. Although some have said, well, the visible element in confession is the pastor himself who pronounces in the stead and by the command of Christ that forgiveness of sins. Since neither Scripture nor the confession say anything about that, neither will I. Jeff calls from his car. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello, Jeff. How are you?
Todd. Yes.
Yes, Todd.
Yeah.
I like the comment line. That's the first time I've heard it. It's excellent. And I just wanted to comment about the comment made about evangelical church and the law.
Oh, yeah.
And I do prison ministry, and because I do prison ministry, I have the understanding of the law literally, as these inmates come in and are bound by the law of the government, which is part of the price they pay for their crime that they've been convicted of. And yet, even in their circumstances, where many of them do not have any chance of getting out, the gospel message that Jesus Christ brings of free grace and forgiveness is what gives them a true freedom, even though they will stay behind razor wire and bars the rest of their life, for many of them.
Thank you very much, Jeff. He's echoing something one of our first commenters made there on the comment line, and that is what he called the freedom of the gospel that he found in Reformation theology in the Lutheran Church that was not found in the evangelical circumstances of where he was before. Think about that. This is what Paul means when he writes to the Galatians, "For freedom Christ has set you free. Do not submit again to a yoke of slavery." Now, what were the Galatians guilty of? They were guilty of saying, well, sure, we're saved by grace through faith for Christ's sake, and what we do subsequent to being saved. In their case, it was just circumcision, and Paul says that's a different gospel. It is not the gospel. If anyone preaches it, let him be eternally accursed, and he calls that a yoke of slavery. And he reminds the Galatians that if you have any stipulation that is man's works following salvation, any stipulation whatsoever, if salvation is turned into probation, then you have obligated that person to keep the whole law and you're back again under that yoke of slavery. You know, of all things, evangelicalism with that name ought to be a clear voice of the freedom of the gospel rather than, well, Christ has set you free. Now, here again is a yoke of slavery, and it's your job to submit to it. Paul will have nothing to do with that, whether it comes in its, and we find it today, whether it comes in its Roman Catholic form or its evangelical form, he will have nothing to do with it. We ready to go with another listener comment?
Little Rock, Arkansas. I am a listener, and I listen mostly online, and I was wondering, I've watched a lot of, we've been talking about atheism lately, and there's the whole Richard Dawkins documentaries he's done, the whole thing that basically says religion is the root of all evil. And in that case, it seems like, as opposed to most atheists, as you talk about, that they're basically running from God and trying to deny God, it seems like he's basically just convinced that there is no God and that kind of thing and scoffs at the idea. And I just wonder what the difference is and how you would respond to some of his comments that that religion basically is the root of all evil. Because in some points, I probably agree with a lot of what he's saying, that sometimes religion can be a problem. But in that way, how Christianity is different from religion in general. So I'm just curious what you would say about that. Thank you. Bye.
All right, now that's a comment from a listener in Little Rock, Arkansas. It's a good question. Dawkins, Richard Dawkins, who's author of the book called The God Delusion, he's a biologist, made quite a name for himself. They're calling him the Jerry Falwell of atheism because he makes kind of over-the-top statements. And he is aimed, I think the listener is right there, he is aimed at Christianity in particular. Now, all the more active, what they're calling themselves, the new atheists, we'll say, no, 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 we've got a problem with religion in general. But when it actually comes down to their rhetoric, what they like to talk about most, it's Christianity they got a problem with. Now, they will discount the God of the Muslim and of the Jew with equal force, but they spend most of their time talking about Christianity. There might be a reason for that. It might be that many of them live in a Christian civilization. That is Christian, small c, a Christian-influenced civilization. Fine and good. Well, I think there is some apologetic force to pointing out that Christianity, while religion itself is not necessarily a good force in society, Christianity among the world's religions is unique, not only in the kind of society that it produces by way of influence, but unique in its theology. That's far more important. All other religions, and this is something, if only this would be conceded by the atheist, I think a huge step would have been taken forward. All other religions except for Christianity are religions of human works. They are essentially what man must do to please or appease or mollify God. Or, in some cases, what man must do to approach God. God is entirely passive. Say the Buddhists, what man must do to approach God or deity. But all of them, save Christianity, are religions of human works. That includes every religion under the sun, save Christianity. Christianity is entirely the opposite. It is a religion of divine works, namely the perfect works of the incarnate Son of God, Jesus Christ, for sinners. And those works are very clearly enumerated: his perfect life, his death, and his resurrection for sinners. If you could get atheists to concede that one difference, you might have gone a long way toward showing them that Christianity isn't just any other religion. Let's go to the next cut.
Just wanted to say that I appreciate all the issues, etc. is doing. You guys are doing a great job of speaking the truth in love. I was also wondering sometime if you'd want to dedicate a weekday show or Sunday evening show to Beth Moore Bible Studies. I'm a pastor at Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod Congregation out in Wyoming. And one of the biggest challenges I have sometimes here is keeping women from not going to Beth Moore Bible Studies. And it's something that seems very appealing to women, but yet it's also tainted with some things that are pretty bad as well. But thank you for all that you guys do, and we sure appreciate your good work out here. God's continued blessings on issues, etc. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for that comment, too. I've had probably a half dozen emails over the last year about Beth Moore, people saying you really have to look into this on the program. We will. It's a matter of one thing pushing out another. And what we want to do, whenever we deal with one of these popular fads that sweeps through the church, we've done it with the Purpose-Driven Life, or the Contagious Christian Movement, all those kind of things. What we want to do is get a panel of guests who have familiarized themselves with the material, and then they can respond in a more cogent way. So it is on the list, and thank you very much for the suggestion. I've heard a lot about Beth Moore, and at this point don't yet know what to make of it because I don't know enough. All I've heard is that it's out there and it's very popular. But what else is new? We're talking about a church that is largely a fad-driven church. One thing after another, about every 18 months, the same church that was doing Purpose-Driven Life, you'll find them doing something like Beth Moore about a year and a half later. And then something else about another year and a half later. Let's go to another comment.
I'm soon to be a pastor in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and have found Issues, etc. to be a wonderful resource, not only for myself as a teacher and leader in the church, but for everyone that I know. I mean, I listen to it as often as I possibly can, and I really look to it for guidance. It's a wonderful program, and keep up the great work. The Lord bless you.
All right, that's nice. I mean, it's very nice to hear. I've noticed that the young men, did he say he was studying to be a Lutheran pastor? Okay. I've noticed that the young men who are studying to be pastors are finding Issues, etc. to be a resource. Now, don't get the impression here that this comment line is only for the glowing compliments of our listeners. We want to hear the good, bad, and the ugly from you. If you disagree, if you have something to say of a negative response, we are very anxious to hear from you. The line 314-505-7825, it's the Issues, etc. comment line. If you heard something that you adamantly disagree with, we want to hear from you as well. And you can always leave your comment anonymously. 314-505-7825. It's open 24 hours to take your comments on anything you've heard here on Issues, etc. Do we have another one there? All right, let's listen to this listener.
Hi, a regular listener to the program. And just wanted you guys to know I so much appreciate your broadcasting of the sermon reviews. Some of those sermons are just wonderful to listen to, but also some of them are wonderful to listen to for other reasons. And that gives us an ability to clearly see when God's Word and the person of Christ is being preached and when he is not. So I so much appreciate it, and I noticed this past week in listening to the broadcast of a sermon review of Ed Young, and it's just a tragedy to see thousands flocking into these mega churches where Christ is not even being preached. I know that you guys probably take criticism for it, but I encourage you to continue to broadcast both the good sermons and the bad sermons that we, the church, might be better able to discern. And I thank you very much.
All right, that's nice to hear. And I will say that's indicative of an awful lot of our listeners who, when you ask them, what's your favorite thing about listening? I do this when I go out and I speak. I'll ask people when they say, listen, well, what do you like best? one of the first things they always mention is the sermon reviews. And they're like this listener. They like the good ones that we play and review, and they like, for other reasons, the ones that we play that are come in for a lot more criticism. Time for one more quickly here. All right.
Hi, I was listening to your broadcast last week of John Warwick Montgomery's response to the new atheism, and I was fairly disappointed. He spoke of the second law of thermodynamics and said that it basically proved that there had to be a God, that the universe was not infinite. Well, that just proves that the universe had a beginning, and most atheists will acknowledge that. So though I think that that's a very helpful thing to say, I just don't think that Dr. Montgomery argued it well at all. And then later on, when he was talking about the new atheists and morality and that they deny Christianity, so they therefore have no basis of morality, I'm wondering what that has to say for the law written on our hearts. Certainly every atheist has the law written on their heart, and they know what is right and they know what is wrong, even if they themselves deny that they know it. And when we completely exclude what God has created in us by way of our conscience and the law written on our heart, I think that we're simply ignoring one of the greatest gifts that we have in bringing people to a knowledge of their sin and destroying their systems so that they can then hear the gospel.
Thank you very much for that comment. I will respond to both of those on behalf of Dr. Montgomery. The second one first, that I don't think it was ever Dr. Montgomery's intention to deny that the law is written on the atheist's heart. In fact, I think he would strongly assert, along with Scripture, that the atheist has the law of God written on his heart, as every person does. What he's saying is their stated denial of God philosophically leaves them with no basis for their morality. Do they in fact have a basis for the morality? Sure they do. You know what it is? The law written on their hearts, but they deny it. It's something that it can actually not be denied. Now, as to whether or not the second law of thermodynamics can be used to prove the existence of God, I don't think Dr. Montgomery was saying it proved the existence of God, but of a source of all these things, which of course the Christian would know to be, in fact, God himself. Well, thanks to everybody who called the Issues Etc. listener comment line. It's always open for your comments, positive and negative, anything you've heard here on Issues Etc., either if you're listening live, online, or on demand. The number again for that listener comment line is 314-505-7825. 314-505-7825. When we come back, we're going to talk about Charles Darwin. It is his birthday, after all.
Radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.